Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Jonathan Xavier, inasmuch as you insist on being an outsider and laughing at the rules and traditions of our advanced civilization, I am exiling you to a place which has no adherence to either. I have no choice but to sentence you to Earth.
That interlude.
I've been in that godforsaken desert for 40 days and 40 nights, all to get away from Johnny and his pack of jackals.
Where is she?
What's up with Johnny? What's he waiting for?
We've seen planet Earth for what it's worth, but there's other planets to explore.
Flying saucer.
Mickey O'Flynn, the man with the grin, is missing.
Oh my God! I might just faint.
I want to tell the whole world that I'm alive.
How do you think you came back?
Welcome to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White.
And I'm Rob St. Mary.
This week we're talking about The Ghastly Love of Johnny X, a brand spanking new film from Paul Bunnell. The film stars Will Keenan as the titular Johnny X. He's a juvenile delinquent from outer space. He's banished to Earth for being a no-goodnik, but luckily for him, he comes to our planet with a very handy resurrection suit that allows him to bring folks back from the dead and do some other nifty stuff. The film has a real rock and roll bent. Two of the major characters in the film include Reggie Bannister as King Clayton, a slightly dishonest promoter, is there any other kind, and Creed Bratton as Mickey O'Flynn, the man with the grin, and now recently deceased, a rock star. So, all right, Rob, did you find Johnny X to be ghastly or great?
Well, I want to get this out on top. I think it's a very, very good film, but I don't think it's great. I think that it needs about 10 minutes taken out. I think that if the editing was a little bit tighter, if the storytelling was a little bit tighter, and it moved just a little bit faster, it would be ghastly great. Beyond that, though, I think that in terms of performances, the look of this thing, the ideas, there's so much stuff going on. It's such a beautiful film to look at. One thing that's really nice about it is that it has that 1950s juvenile delinquent film vibe, but it's not a parody or spoof of said films.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. It looks absolutely gorgeous. The black and white cinematography is great. When Johnny's got his resurrection suit on, just the whites against the blacks and everything just looks really, really nice. I think it's also a very good film. The one criticism I have is the Sluggo character, where he's so not in the film until a certain point, and then he's in the film continuously after that. And I rewatched the film last night, actually, and I was just like, I'm looking for Sluggo. And I see him in the back, and he gets a line here and there in one of the songs. And we should say up front that this is a musical as well.
Yeah, I think it's a rather good musical, too. As you were talking about the Sluggo character, I think maybe this is an issue that as we know from the interview and some of our reading is that it was a movie that was made over a relatively long period of time.
That's true. So I don't know if they really knew going in what was going to happen or if they got the coverage that they needed, that kind of stuff. But I mean, Sluggo's there in the first song and he's there in the background a little bit, but there's that What's Up With Johnny song, which is very pivotal to the film, at least to me. And he's there, but he's very much in the background. He's not singing. I don't know if maybe Sluggo wasn't the greatest singer in the world or something, but I mean, he's a great character once he kind of comes out of his shell, but just that you don't see him as much as you go through it. I agree, could be a little bit tighter. I really got a lot more out of subsequent viewings, I have to say. The first time I watched it, I was like, yeah, this is pretty good. Second time I watched it, I was like, okay, there is a lot of stuff going on in this film, you know, just the relationships, you know, who's related to who, who's been going out with who. Not to say that I didn't get that the first time, because I am not completely stupid, but I didn't get all of that kind of stuff the first time through. It really kind of resonated a lot more on second and third viewing.
And I think that ultimately that's the thing that's really nice about it, is that it has the ability to hold up on the viewings. The music is very catchy. It's very well done. And it's not really, it's not derivative in that, you know, it's tonally, much like we were talking about with Grace of My Heart, it's of the era, but it doesn't really echo any particular song. It's not like they're saying, okay, well, this song is this song, and we're just going to sort of strip out the lyrics and put something new in it.
See this A. It's an A for a net.
Oh, man.
Do you like my A?
Uh-huh.
Well, look at it and like it, because it's all that you get.
They went in and they really gave the film, in terms of its music, not only the musical songs, but the score pieces, its own real flavor that is sort of steeped in that 1950s sound. So I think they to be commended in terms of the overall tonality of the music, how it fits into the plot structure of the film. So I'm a big fan of this. As a matter of fact, I'm wondering if they're deciding to put out some sort of soundtrack record on this.
Definitely hope they do, because that Green-Eyed Monster song that Mickey O'Flynn, the man with the grin, sings, I really like that song.
I'm like a
And I really do like What's Up With Johnny. That one kind of sticks in my head long after I'm done watching the film. And, you know, hearing it again, rewatching it, I was just like, yeah, this is really, you know, quite a good song. And it goes on for a long time. It's not like, and I should probably say too, I mean, there's so many different flavors of musical. There's like the Evita type of musical where nothing really is spoken. And then there's the Rocky Horror type of musical where you, every once in a while, you get a song and it kind of propels the narrative along. This is kind of like that, but just a little bit more pared back, because there aren't constant songs. You know, the songs come when they should, and it's not like they're kind of forcing these things in there, and it's not like one of these kind of Oklahoma things where it's like, you know, oh, you want me to tell you about that? Well, and the orchestra swells up. So I think they did a good job of mixing the way that the songs come in with the actual narrative. And you're right, the songs fit with that kind of 50s aesthetic, though it's kind of a weird thing, and I know we'll talk about this a little bit later on too, about that this is kind of almost like an alternate version of Earth. It's not it's not today. It's not the 1950s. It's maybe today on, you know, I don't know my DC universe too well, but it's like today on Earth 33 or something.
It's like Bizarro World.
Maybe Bizarro World, but people don't say goodbye when they show up and then hello when they leave. But
you know, one of the things that's really nice in terms of hitting that tonality, obviously, is the music, but the design and that black and white cinematography, their idea to go with that, I think was a real risk. You have all of these things that you're trying to do as an independent filmmaker. You're trying to make a movie that would be commercially viable to some extent. And it's like, there's not a lot of black and white movies that are made. And to decide to make a black and white film really is a standout thing. But to shoot it in such a way, it's so good. It's not that it has almost this sort of documentary feel. This, I'd have to say, is very lush. It's almost the equivalent of like Tim Burton's Ed Wood. It looks like it was the same guy that shot it. And just really kind of creamy look in the skin, nice black and white look. And I was just really impressed with it sort of across the board, at least in terms of the visual style with the cinematography.
The other thing is that it really makes people, you know, look good. I mean, I don't know how attractive these people are in real life or not, but man, oh man, they just all look so good in this film. And this doesn't look like one of those, you know, we shot it in color and sapped the color later on. It feels like this was actually shot in, you know, with a black and white stock and film rather than, you know, any kind of just digital trickery, which is, again, very risky for a filmmaker in this day and age to do. I mean, you know, there's the cost of the film itself. There's screwed up takes where you can't use it, all that kind of stuff that we talked to the Superb Man guys about. But, you know, this is probably one of the last ones that we'll get. In fact, I think that the film stock that this was shot on was discontinued while they were shooting it. And the filmmaker had to go out and just snatch up as much of the Kodak stock as he possibly could, which is kind of sad.
You know, what's funny is you talk about how they all look really good in black and white. Sort of reminds me of the introduction that's on the front of The Third Man, where they interview Peter Bogdanovich. And obviously, he was a guy who hung out with Orson Welles. And Bogdanovich, I remember, says in this interview, he goes, Orson always used to talk about black and white as being the actor's friend. He's like, name me. He's like, Orson used to say, name me a great performance in color. He's like, you can't do it. He's like, you can't do it. He goes, black and white is the actor's friend. So it's maybe old Orson, who's been gone now over 25 years, maybe has something on that. So I don't know.
You can't say in July. Name me a sentence that begins with in July. Yeah, everyone looks great. The women in this are really looking good. And though the main woman sometimes looks a little scary, sometimes looks fantastic. So it just depends on, I guess, kind of the angle with that.
The actors in this are great. I mean, Will Keenan, I'm going to put on the record right now, just to let you know in advance, if I do have any bias on Will Keenan, I did give him some money for a film he did a few years ago. So I was an investor in one of his earlier films. But I met Will Keenan through Troma, because Troma put out one of my movies. And when I saw him with like Tromeo, which we're going to talk about a few episodes down the road, I was like, this guy is really good. I mean, and that was like his first starring role. And I've seen a lot of the stuff. I mean, obviously he's done a lot of things, but it's like, I've seen a lot of the stuff that he's done and really always impressed with him. And he's a guy that can really do humor, but not be over the top with it. Like, it's just gesture and look and line deliveries and stuff like that.
What should we do, boss? Should we make him talk? Knock his block, clean his clock?
Get cool, Polly. If this fine, upstanding citizen and his fine, upstanding wife?
Girlfriend.
Whatever. Have anything to tell us, I'm sure that's exactly what they're gonna do. Right?
That's right, super duper daddy-o.
So, where is she?
One thing that they don't bring out in Johnny X, that's one of Will's strong suits, is his physicality. For a while, he wanted to do a biopic. He was talking about doing a biopic of Buster Keaton, in which he was going to play Buster Keaton. And he's probably the only guy that I could think of that might be able to pull off all the stunts like that. Because if you see some of his work that he does in other films, the guy can throw himself around and you're amazed he can walk away from it.
I've never met the man, but he is very cute on film, I will say. And he looks, I mean, does he have a painting somewhere that's just looking worse and worse as the days go on? Because he looks exactly the same, to me at least, as he did in Tromeo.
He must preserve himself or something. I have no idea. You know, but the thing that's great about Will in this is Johnny X is that he has that look. He has that look of that sort of what we would consider from those 1950s films, from those juvenile delinquent films, that really, you know, dark hair, leather jacketed, greaser look. I'd have to say, though, you know, in terms of that image, that it sits really well sort of like on the shelf of that look when you talk about maybe a character like the Fonz or like a Danny Zuko from Grease. He kind of fits in there where it's like, you know, if Johnny X was hanging out with either of those guys, he'd fit right in.
Yeah, and look out. Those guys will kick your ass. Yeah, the one thing I'm curious, what's your opinion as far as the soda jerk character?
I thought the soda jerk character was interesting offhand. His name is Chip in the film. And I thought it was a good counterpoint. You know, it plays into a lot of the stuff that you see in those 50s films about sort of like teenage love and sort of like the two guys competing for the girl and all that stuff. I thought he did a really nice job with it and sort of has to play the straight man quite a bit, because the girl who plays Bliss, who's Johnny X's girlfriend, she is really good in terms of her line delivery and her presence and the way that she sort of has this like sex kitten persona. You need someone who can play against that really well, and I think he does an awesome job with it.
Yeah, their scenes together are terrific. And yeah, I love all of her double entendres.
What can I get you?
Make it cold and wet, handsome.
A pop?
With a twist of lime? Chip, my name is Bliss. Repeat it.
Bliss.
That's nice. I like the way you say that. Let's try another one. You see that desert?
Yeah, I see it.
You know what's sitting out there?
No. What?
Lizards.
Lizards?
That's right. A whole bunch of lizards. Do you know what those lizards are doing? They're looking for me, that's what they're doing. And you know why? They wanna lick me.
Lick you? You mean...
Doesn't matter. All that does matter is... You are no lizard, and you don't remind me of him.
And it's a very well-written film, too. You know, I was complaining earlier about the lack of Sluggo, but as far as, like, the lines and everything, I mean, there are some very quotable lines in this thing, stuff that I'm probably going to pick up and use myself as far as, you know, the party doesn't start until you see the whites of their thighs. Yeah, very good line.
Some of the great sort of extras casting, not extras casting, but, you know, some of the folks who came in, you know, day players, little cameos and stuff like that. It is really great in Johnny X because it starts with, for me, a guy, totally underappreciated character actor, Kevin McCarthy. And not only that, but this is a guy who then echoes back to that 1950s because he was the star of the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers. So, I mean, what more could you want, you know, in that, to have him leading this tribunal in the beginning of the film that decides to send Johnny X and his friends to Earth because, of course, they're just undisciplined and they're horrible, irreverent people who will not conform to the society in which they've created.
Do you really wish to become that? Undisciplined, irreverent, tasteless. I'd like to advise you to choose your next words carefully, because this may be your last chance to find grace among your own people.
So it was just a pleasure to see him.
He is always a favorite. I'm a huge fan of the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I don't mind the I very much like the Philip Kaufman remake. Not too much of a fan of the Abel Ferrara remake, but I do very much enjoy those first two. But yeah, he was always so great. I mean, I loved him, especially in like UHF. He was great in that too. I mean, anytime he showed up in a movie, you knew you were in for a treat. And then it was also nice, too, to see a small part from Paul Williams.
Yeah, and you're a huge Paul Williams fan, so I'm going to let you go off about Paul Williams' cousin Quilty, the talk show host.
Yeah, they're out there traveling along. You've got Mickey O'Flynn and Sluggo and that kind of, I don't know how to describe that kind of Earth child girl who's very sexualized, but, you know, still pretty, let's say, innocent. But anyway, they're out traveling around past midnight, and they decide to drop in on Uncle Quilty. And yeah, Paul Williams, great to see. He is looking very nice in this film as well, and just kind of putting on a really hamming it up.
Are you brain damaged or drunk? We're on the air. Where are we working tomorrow? Ooh, this is a nice surprise.
Oh, no, don't tell me. Let me guess. The Martians have landed.
Oh, it's better than that.
Better than Martians.
I have to tell you folks, there have been a lot of weird rumors circulating about this man. Tabloids have been reporting that he's dropped dead or disappeared or even worse. But evidently nothing could keep him away from Cousin Quilty's show tonight. Put your hands together, ladies and gentlemen, for one of the greatest singers of all time. The man with the grin, Mickey O'Flynn.
The one thing about the Paul Williams character that I thought was kind of interesting is, it's like you said, a talk show that starts at midnight. To me, it kind of reminded me like maybe like they got the idea from like Art Bell, because Art Bell used to have this radio program that was always on and like overnights on AM radio, and he would talk about aliens and all kinds of, you know, Bigfoot sightings and stuff like that. And that's what they're kind of talking about. Like there's this gal who's on the show, and she's kind of talking about, oh, well, like abductions and stuff like that. And he's like, oh yeah, I know. It's like they tried to abduct me. And it's great to see him. I mean, he's just, you know, great actor, obviously an amazing songwriter and performer in his own right, going back to when you guys did the episode on the Phantom of the Paradise. And just in terms of his output as a musician, as a songwriter, it's quite incredible. And I know he's long been a hero of yours, someone you've really enjoyed.
Yeah, definitely. You know, God, I can't believe you threw out Art Bell. That was great to hear. I used to, every once in a while, people would come into where I was working and be like, did you hear this on Art Bell? Did you hear about this? And so, yeah, it was great. Good comparison.
Well, I mean, you know, he was one of those presents on broadcasting for like 20 years. So, I mean, when I first started in radio, when I started on the commercial band and talk radio in the newsroom, he was on. I would roll in, you know, to do the morning shift and catch the end of Art Bell. And I didn't necessarily agree that there were werewolves and, you know, aliens, but he always made it entertaining nonetheless.
Yeah, definitely. And he was a big fan of Tesla, which I like a lot, too. Not the band, but the actual inventor.
What, there was a band that Nikola Tesla was in?
Nikola Tesla, he played the bass. So he used to make some really funny looking faces.
Of course, because that's the very sexy position for any up-and-coming musician, is to play the bass.
Exactly. And plus, he always used to think about how much money he was making while he was playing and try to add up the amount of money compared to how many notes he was playing.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back with an interview that Mike and I did with director Paul Bunnell and star Reggie Bannister.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOF at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
All right, I'm here with Bill Byforce and Mr. Chris to tell you a little bit about Outside the Cinema.
All right, Reverend Scott, take us to church.
What can we expect to find from a typical show?
2 hours of just random blabber.
Is there anyone's coattails you rode in on to popularity?
I'm the guy that f***ing burns the coattails and then pisses on them.
You review all these exploitation, horror, comedy, cult, and often all-around terrible movies. You must have a strong driving force that keeps you going.
Ego.
I don't know if I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while.
Really?
I have been saying that for a while. Also, I'm high on smack.
Well, it's definitely working for you guys. Yeah. People are coming out in droves to support you on iTunes.
We just the other day got a one-star review on iTunes.
Well, that is one star too many. Let me tell you, the worst f***ing piece of shit I've ever heard.
This has been great, guys.
Thanks, God. That was good. Oh, he's got you crying over there.
I'm good for the rest of the year.
Nice.
That was too much.
Johnny, oh Johnny, why can't you Johnny be good? Behave a bit more normal, like an earthly teenager should.
I got the idea from a bunch of different movies that I was watching in the late 90s, and I had kind of wanted to do something based on the kind of sci-fi juvenile delinquents films, you know, the lower budget sci-fi films, but not in a spoofy way. I wanted to do something just kind of fun, and as if I were doing one of those sorts of films today, contemporary, yet it had some of the sensibilities of the 1950s and stuff in there, with the cars and the costumes and that sort of thing. Originally, it was just going to be the gang themselves were going to be the 1950s-looking gang, and everything else was going to be modern and contemporary. But I ended up going kind of with a look to the whole movie that has sort of a 1950s, 60s look, and sprinkled a little bit of 70s in there as well. Although the film does not take place in any of those time periods, it takes place kind of in a today alternate reality sort of thing, but nobody seems to get that, including the cast members. So, and you know, the black and white thing wasn't done really to make it feel like an old movie, because I've done black and white before, and I just kind of like black and white. You know, it just was seemed like the right way to go with this project, and I had never done 35 millimeter widescreen black and white, you know, anamorphic, which a couple of my favorite films from the period in the 70s, Manhattan by Woody Allen was shot that way, and also The Elephant Man by David Lynch. And I really, and a lot of great older films too, but, you know, I loved the look of that, and I'd always wanted to do it. Black and white to me makes you get lost in a dream, and you feel like you're not in reality. You're removed from the color, which is a distraction to me sometimes. And, you know, I just think black and white is a beautiful thing. It really is.
How were you able to get it made? I mean, I'm sure people weren't running in your direction to hand you fistful of cash to try and make this kind of movie, especially in black and white, because it seems like something that wouldn't go over too well with commercial audiences.
I got the money through basically just the way I've always done it.
Robbed a bank, right?
Yeah, I robbed a bank. As a matter of fact, there was a Bank of America right down the street from my house, so we were tunneling.
Yeah, I remember that.
That's right. I was tunneling under the street, and for 6 years I was waiting to get to that bank vault, and that's why it took us that long to finish the film, you know.
It was a long tunnel, yeah.
But no, it was self-financed. We had no outside interference. I had tried just about every company at the time, but my wife and I started the picture with some money that we had, and we also borrowed a little additional money against our house. And then we realized it was going to be a little bit more expensive to make the picture than we thought. So we went ahead and sort of put the thing on hold until we can raise some more money. And we cut a really neat production teaser. And, you know, we just had no luck. I had a lot of companies saying, oh, this looks great. Call us when you get it done. You know, we'd love to see it. But they wouldn't put up any money. So 6 years later, when I'm just about at the end of my rope and four nervous breakdowns later, I decided that I was about ready to hang it up. I thought, well, I don't even me, the guy with the stick-to-itivity, you know, I don't know even if I can get this thing done, you know. But finally, a friend of mine, an old friend of mine, came forward, and he was in a position to help and said, you know what, I'm going to help you finish this thing. And thank goodness he did. So he gave us the money to finish the film. Well, I'm just ever so grateful. And his name is Mark Willoughby. And if he's listening, sorry, I didn't mean to reveal your identity. Yeah.
So 6 years, what was going on during that whole time, and how do you keep a cast together during that whole period?
I would just keep calling everyone when I thought it was getting close and say, hey, how you guys doing? You know, how's your hair? You know, your hair is still the same. You know, you losing any weight? Are you gaining any weight? You know, so I would just kind of keep everybody in the loop, and even Will Keenan admitted to me that he thought that after the first year, he thought, oh, this can happen, and the second year, by the time the third year rolled around, he said he just humored me every time I called. He said, you know, this, to himself, this isn't going to happen, and he just humored me and wished me the best, and never thought in his wildest dreams that he would be finishing the movie. But we did, and I think I surprised everyone there. Reggie, what would you say about that?
They all look the same.
You guys all look the same.
Isn't that weird?
I thought that, you know, when I got back on that set 6 years later, I thought that I was doing season six of like a series with the same characters, and it was the most bizarre feeling.
I know. It was really odd.
To have everybody back.
Yeah.
And their costumes fit. We didn't need any alterations.
It's that far out.
Wow. You know, I mean, talk about, you know, I was the only one that aged, really. I mean, you know, I was...
Reggie, when I think of you, I don't normally think of you kind of belting out, you know, the big show tunes and everything. How was that? I mean, have you sung on film before?
Well, yeah, you know, I've been a musician all my life, I usually describe it as being blessed with two curses, or vice versa, cursed with two blessings. Music and theater, film, acting. What's interesting, though, you guys, about a musician, I've made a lot of albums as well. A musician doing a character, or, you know, singing a character in a film or in the theater, is that you want to sing it like that character, and you don't want to sing it like you normally would sing your own stuff, if you know what I mean. And so when you see it back, you go, wow, that's really kind of far out, because that's King Clayton, and that's not me. That's not the way Reg sings. So,
I knew Reggie's musical background, of course, and if you've seen the original Phantasm, you see them doing this little number with their guitars, and I think that was something you guys improvised, right, Reggie? On
Phantasm? Yeah, it was Sitting Here at Midnight. That was actually Bill Thornberry's idea for a song, and he had just come up with it like something like the night before. We needed about 30 seconds of stuff in that spot, and they had already shot me at my ice cream parlor in Phantasm doing a bunch of songs, so I thought, my own, and I thought, well, gee, I'll be terribly gracious, and so I won't do my song in here. Well, ask Bill, if he has a song that he can put in the movie.
The movie project itself was not started as a musical. I knew there was the character of Mickey O'Flynn, who was going to sing a couple of songs in concert or whatever. And then one day, when I wasn't really happy with the way the script was progressing, I looked at one of the scenes and I said, all this stuff in the diner, it goes on and on and on and on. Why don't we just throw in a musical number here to end all musical numbers? But we loved it so much that we kept on doing that, and we added five or six songs. And so now technically Johnny X, that's why I jokingly say the movie is not a musical, but I guess it sort of is. It's not it's not a song every 5 minute kind of thing, but we don't use the rockabilly tunes. We use more of a West Side Story kind of a take on songs.
Looking at the casting a little bit, we already talked a little bit about Will Keenan. How did you come across him and then decide to put him in as your lead?
Well, I had known the look that I wanted for the character, and Ramsey Abed is one of my associate producers, a fellow I met recently at the time, and he referred me. He kept giving me names for different people to be different things, and then he referred me to this guy named Will Keenan. Well, honestly, I'd never heard of him, and that doesn't mean anything. I wasn't too familiar with Creed Bratton before either, but so I checked out his reel, Will Keenan's reel, and I thought, well, he kind of looks like he could be the character, and he's sort of funny, although I was going for more of a quiet, sort of tormented character in Johnny X. But I met with him, and he was great. He wanted to do it, and I thought he would be cool. I originally wanted the character to smoke cigarettes, but Will Keenan did not want to smoke and put that role model out there, so I came up with the black liquor sticks that Johnny X pulls out every now and again instead of cigarettes. So that actually kind of adds a fun little dimension.
And Kevin McCarthy is just such a great character actor who's like all over the place. And
oh, yeah.
And I understand this is his final role. I mean, can you kind of tell me how you got to know him and how you got into the piece?
I met Kevin at a film festival that I attend every year in Hollywood called CineCon, that's held at the Egyptian Theater, and Kevin was a guest, and they were running a couple of his movies, not the typical ones you would expect, like Body Snatchers, but they were running a picture called Nightmare, which was made in 1956 with Edward G. Robinson. It was a noir film, and I thought this was just fantastic, and here's Kevin McCarthy, and I'd seen him around town, in the past and stuff, and seen him in, more recent movies that Joe Dante was directing, and I approached him and asked him if he was still acting, and he said yes, and asked if he would be interested in taking a look at a script, and he said yes, and so he gave me his number, and it just was that simple. And then he told me no, and then he told me yes, and then he told me no, and then he told me yes, so he waffled a little bit, but ultimately he was great to work with, and it was really cool to have him in the movie. And that's kind of a similar way how I met Paul Williams. I met Paul. I'd always been a big fan of his. I went to a screening of Phantom of the Paradise that Paul was going to be at, and I approached Paul after the thing, and I said, are you still doing acting? Yes. You know, well, I've got something I'd love to. So he gave me his email address right there. You know, he took me aside and he told me it, and I contacted him, and it kind of went from there, you know. And it took a lot of coaxing to get Paul Williams on board, because I think he's a very picky person about what he does. And, you know, it was really very difficult to, you know, originally he was supposed to play Mickey O'Flynn. And then he got a little busy once we got our money, and I had to recast. So we got him on board, and we got Creed Bratton as Mickey, and it all worked out just, you know, swimmingly. And he took me aside afterwards, and he said, you know, you made a great choice with Creed Bratton. He's going to be great as Mickey O'Flynn. So, you know, he gave his thumbs up to that.
Were there any challenges that you know, other than getting the folks back together and everything, but were there any kind of technical challenges that you faced, or any kind of, interesting kind of, asides that you can share with us as far as what that presented?
The only real challenge I had was just trying to make everything work on the limited time schedule that we had, because we had a very short shooting schedule. But the only real problem we had was when we were shooting at the drive-in the very first time, and we had a nice, beautiful, sunny day, and we shot, and then we were going to come back on the second day, and this was in Barstow, California, miles and miles and miles from where we're at, you know, like 2-hour drive or whatever. And the second day, the rain started coming in that night, and it started to snow, and I couldn't believe it. I had everybody up there in a hotel, and it was snowing, and it was a disaster. And that was how we left the first part of the filming. I had to leave on that sour note. And so when I got the money 6 years later, we went back to the scene of the crime, and we finished those scenes at the drive-in. And I'm telling you, there's a couple of cuts in that drive-in sequence, you know, during these Lips That Never Lie, where they're singing in 2004 or sitting in a car, and then they get out in 2010, and we cut. You would never know it. The actors didn't change. You would never. I challenge you to tell me where those scenes are.
I thought, in terms of production and the acting and everything, it's a great piece. I thought it was a phenomenal film, and I'm looking forward to seeing what you can do with it. So, you know, I know this is just sort of starting to roll out with various festivals and things like that, but what's been the reaction when you've started to show it now that it's locked and it's finished?
Most of the folks that I've seen watch the film were laughing, and, you know, when we have a big audience, and very positive. I mean, Reggie, wouldn't you say that they seem to dig it? I mean,
Oh, yeah. Again, everybody, when we were up at Cinequest and saw it with, you know, that room full of strangers in the dark, it was a lot of fun. They had a lot of fun. And
well, I'm glad to hear you say that, Reggie. I'll see you at midnight then.
I'll see you there. Your house or mine?
Yeah, well, at the theater, of course.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, so you know, it's interesting because a girl came up to me after one of the screenings, and she just profusely thanked me for making the movie. She said, thank you for making this movie for me, you know. And I felt so good about that. And I had fun making the movie, and I'm glad you guys enjoyed it. And I was so thrilled to be able to work with Reggie again. And I think we'll work again, Reggie, right?
Oh, I think absolutely.
We'll work on the next picture I'm going to do.
So we'll talk to you in 2018, is that right?
No. This one will be getting going much quicker than that. I'm going to get the next one. It's based on a Victor Hugo novel called The Man Who Laughs. And we're working on the script right now, and we hope to get into production, as soon as we can, really. And it's going to be a really cool movie. It's going to be totally different than Johnny X. There's no singing, no dancing, but there is a boy with a hideously shaped face who is his face. Well, you know, I don't even want to discuss it.
No, don't talk about it.
It's just going to be marvelous, and it's my own take on it. We're doing our own version of based on Victor Hugo's novel.
Welcome back. Here's a bonus interview we did with Johnny X himself, Will Keenan.
What's up with Johnny?
Why are we hanging around?
This place is cute, but it's time to scoot because the resurrection suit was found.
So how did you get involved with the whole Johnny X thing?
You know, it's a funny story, and I don't know what
what Paul says these days, but years and years ago, I think it was like my first or second year in L.A., a mutual acquaintance of ours, indie filmmaker named Ramzi Abed, was friends with Paul, and I had met him somewhere, I think via kind of the trauma connections. And then he set up this meeting with Paul and I. Remember, it was out in Burbank at the Bob's Big Boy, and Paul was telling me his vision about this movie, and he asked me to play the lead, and I said, sure. And then I think it was just a couple months later, maybe, that we shot for about a week, and he got about, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes worth of footage. And I think at the time he was hoping to, and again, I don't know what he says about all this, but I think at the time he was hoping to cut something together and then raise the rest of the funds for the movie. None of us knew this at the time. We were just like, oh, we're shooting for a week, and then we'll shoot, you know, a couple weeks later or something. But then, you know, I think because it's a kind of a highly stylized kind of throwback to the 50s kind of piece, you know, in black and white, a musical, very niche oriented, he was having trouble getting the rest of the funding. And then every year he would call us, me and the rest of the cast, be like, I think I got the money this time. And every, you know, years and years would, you know, years went by. I think it was like 6 or 7 years. So after the second year, I stopped kind of just believing it, you know, just figured the movie would never get made. And then I was producing a movie called Politics of Love. And then I starred in Trent's movie right after. And I got the call from Paul saying, I got the money. And I was like, yeah, sure, whatever. And then I started getting calls from the production manager, and the wardrobe people came over to fit me. And I was like, oh, wait a minute, this might actually be happening. And then at the time I said, hey, you know, I was really, really busy with the films I was producing. And I said, look, you only got 15, you know, 20 minutes in the can. Why don't you recast? I actually tried to talk him into recasting, but he wouldn't do it. And I got to give him credit, you know, not only for being able to kind of stick with the movie for that long, but, you know, to be able to get everyone back together after that many years and, you know, finally to pull it off. And, you know, it's a great little movie. I really, really enjoy the movie itself. And I hope hope it continues to play fast and kind of hits that audience. I think there is an audience for that movie. And I just hope it finds it, you know, but so far, so good.
When you were working on it, what were you trying to bring across with the character? What were you trying to develop with it?
I like the idea that it was going to be done in a style I had never done before. You know, black and white and you know, like kind of Paul's vision with, you know, kind of, like I said, kind of a throwback to the 50s. And it was the first character I'd been asked to play that wasn't like crazy. You know, it was my kind of strong, silent character that I had never gotten to play before. So I was really excited about that.
How was it kind of playing a musical? Because is this the first musical that you've done?
Yes. It was the first time I sang on camera. And, you know, besides Paul being, and Paul's definitely one of the most kind of creative and fun directors I've ever worked with. It was really cool to watch him work on set. And he always, you know, the vibe on set was always really, really good. But when he had first contacted me about it, when we had talked about it at that Bob's Big Boy, I thought, you know, I was the lead in what gets credit for being the first digital feature film, Love God, back in 1996. And I'm convinced that Johnny X will be the last widescreen black and white musical ever. You know, so I was like, damn, I definitely want to do this. Not only is it a character I've never gotten to play, like a kind of strong silent type, but it's the kind of movie that may never be made again. And to boot, I get to sing. And I don't consider myself a singer, really, although I can carry a tune. But, you know, I thought, you know, I like to try new things, obviously, and I thought it'd be cool to, for posterity's sake, to have sung in a movie and be on a soundtrack singing. And I think I did all right at that.
Did you get to keep the jacket when everything was over?
No. And that,
no?
Not at all. And, you know, my costume, my wardrobe in that film was, I'm told, an exact replica of what Brando wore in The Wild One. And it was a, you know, very cool outfit. And, you know, Paul's wife, it was the costume designer, and she works a whole lot in Hollywood as a wardrobe designer. So they put, you know, all the girls and guys, gangs, you know, wardrobe together. And, you know, she was very on top of it. One of the most professional people I've ever worked with. And, you know, yes, I tried to walk away with it. and they wouldn't let me in. And in fact, a year later, I asked to borrow it for a shoot, and they wouldn't even let me borrow it.
Wow.
Yeah. They either spent a whole lot of money and want to keep it, or they're creating a museum in their house, and they're putting it in there.
That was Will Keenan. And, of course, we'll hear more from Will in a few weeks when we cover his first starring role in Troma's classic Romeo and Juliet. Now, Mike, I know this is something that we alluded to during the interview with Paul and Reggie, but I wanted to know how you felt about that sort of timeless aesthetic that's going on in Johnny X.
I think that it works. It took me a little by surprise when there were things that seemed kind of anachronistic. It kind of reminded me of Edward Scissorhands, where you're watching it and everything seems to be in a 1950s setting. And then Anthony Michael Hall's like, you know, my dad's VCR and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, whoa, VCR or an answering machine and stuff. It's like, this stuff didn't exist in the 50s. And it's like, well, maybe had you kind of introduced that a little bit earlier, then it would have made a little bit less jarring, as it were. But yeah, with Johnny X, I think for the most part it works, though I keep insisting in my mind as I'm watching it that it is Earth of the 1950s rather than Earth whatever of the 2000 and whatevers, just because there were some things that just kind of struck me as being out of time. I don't know about you. How does it work for you?
You know, actually, I don't think it's that anachronistic. I remember, like, you were talking about things where, okay, it's supposed to be set in the 50s, or at least that's the idea, and then they'll have things like, you know, someone sucking on a Big Gulp or something. But it's I think they were very faithful to the time period. I mean, with the cars and with the hair and the dress and everything like that, there's really not too many things that kind of stick out for me that doesn't seem to fit within that aesthetic. I mean, they even went so far as to, with the TV show where they show it on the TV, it's shown on a screen that's like a 1950s television. The ads that they put in for the TV show are 1950s ads. The Coke bottles are 1950s Coke bottles. The diner, you know, scene is very 1950s. So as much as it seems to play in this alternate universe of 1950 California desert kind of thing, I think it's very faithful. You can really see that they put an eye to the design and really tried to keep a lot of iconic ideas within it. So to me, it doesn't seem so sort of fish out of water. There's not too many things in there that have a tendency to pull me out and go, oh, this isn't of that time.
But there are just a few things here and there where it's just like, whoa, you know, but that's just mostly me being, I don't know, being kind of sucked into the world. And then every once in a while, it's like, you know, but this world is bigger than just this time period. So I don't know if that makes any sense.
You know, a lot of this, I think, was shot around like Monument Valley. So there's a lot of stuff in there that if you've seen 50s sci-fi or you've seen like Westerns and stuff like that, that you're like, oh, okay, I totally know this landscape because it's kind of burned into your head that this is sort of the go-to place when we need to go to the desert in sci-fi movies of the 50s or Westerns, cheapy Westerns.
Just that cave entrance reminded me of a lot of It Came from Outer Space or The Thing That Conquered the World. The one with Leslie Nielsen and Lee Van Cleef that they used to do on MST3K all the time. You know, he learned too late that man was a feeling creature, and it had that great kind of pointy alien that came out of that cave. So, but that's just me. And Robot Monster, you know, also very famous for its cave and everything.
So, you know, not only does it sort of echo these 1950s movies, I would put Johnny X sort of in the same vein as there seems to have been, I'd say maybe over the last 10, 15 years, where people have gone in and they've taken a lot of these cheap sci-fi aesthetics and tried to sort of remake in some way sort of the ideas or the sort of the tropes of those films and put them in a modern context. And one of which that came out, I think it was in 2000, was La Skeleton of Cadavra. And I remembered that one specifically because people were talking about it and were like, oh, this is like, you know, someone making an Ed Wood movie today or something. And I think that Johnny X is in that vein, but I would actually say it's probably on a higher level.
I know Lost Skeleton is very polarizing, which is so bizarre that a movie like that would either, you know, you love it or you hate it so much of the time, because there are people that just kind of rejected that faux cheapness and everything. For me, I enjoyed it. I don't go back and watch it, and I've never seen the sequel to it or anything. The one that really got under my skin and really just kind of drove me crazy was this one called Alien Trespass with the guy from Will and Grace in it. That one just seemed like they were trying way too hard to do that kind of 50s thing and just not understanding the fun of it, or, you know, it looked like they weren't having fun with that movie, and it wasn't fun to watch. It was a real slog to watch. But then you compare that to something like John Pace's Invasion, or aka Top of the Food Chain, where it does kind of have this 50s feel to it, but there's just so many bizarro little turns and jokes and all this kind of stuff that you can, the people in the film are, you know, very deadpan, especially the professor character is very, very straight-laced and everything. But what he says is so ridiculous that it's just so fun to watch and so funny. I guess it's either way, you know. And then there's a film, I don't know if you've ever seen J. Wade Edwards' Shout, Stomp, Scream. I also have to pause before I say that. That one has that kind of 50s aesthetic, plays it straight, but also is having fun at the same time. It's not making fun of the 1950s aesthetic. It's just kind of using that as a springboard to tell a story. If you're a fan of the 1950s films and you're not making fun of the films, if you have a real respect for them, I mean, and I kind of go back and forth. It just depends on what the movie is. Shout, Stomp, Scream, it kind of does that with the best as far as these films.
I think that you really hit the nail on the head, though, is that people who enjoy those, say you enjoy the Ed Wood films, or you enjoy the some of the early Roger Corman stuff, there is an earnestness to it. They're not trying to do something camp and kitsch. They're just trying to make a film. And in their trying to make the film, it becomes camp and kitsch. So I can understand where that division is with something like Lost Skeleton, where when I saw it, I liked it, but I wasn't like bowled over by it. I know some people are like, oh, this is amazing. I'm like, not really, because they know what keys to hit now. They know what keys to hit in order to make the that idea happen, where back in the 50s, they were just trying to make the movie, and that's just how it happened to come out.
So, you know, one of the films that kind of gets lumped in with these, and one of the films that always drives me crazy when people say, oh, this movie, it's so bad that it's good, and, you know, people kind of latched onto it and da-da-da-da-da, was the Rocky Horror Picture Show. To me, that wasn't a poorly made film. It definitely was kind of a throwback to the 1950s, but it was that kind of, I don't know what it was about the 1950s being this kind of trope in the 1970s, you know, and then again in the 2000s. But we should probably talk a little bit about how these kind of cheapy sci-fi films, they kind of, you know, they played well with the whole musical genre, you know, and it really fits well with Johnny X. It fits well with Rocky Horror. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's kind of built into our maybe our cultural intelligence, because when we think about the 50s, I would say now, at least in terms of where most people come from pop culture, when it comes to the 50s, I'd say probably their first latch in might even be music. You're looking at things like Elvis. And then I would say, even for people my generation who are in their early 30s, it's Grease. So for us, the 50s has always been about like guys in leathers with slick back hair singing songs. So I don't understand. You know, I mean, to me, it works. So it's like it's kind of already built in some way into, I would say, our cultural intelligence on the 50s, at least in the pop culture realm. So I don't think it's that much of a stretch. I think it gets harder when you try to move it to other eras for some reason, because we don't really have a musical that maybe defines that particular era.
Right. I guess the only thing I would throw in there is kind of Reefer Madness, the musical, which it is set, I believe, in the 30s or 40s, but it sure has a 50s feel. It definitely has that mom and apple pie, you know, Eisenhower era kind of thing going on to it. And that's another one that is, to me, absolutely terrific. You know, a musical that they tried to make, oh God, I want to say recently, but it was probably 10 years ago, that just doesn't work for me. And it's one of these films, these kind of being lumped in with this, you know, cult film grouping. And I've tried to watch it now three times, and I just can never make it past the first, I'd say, 15, 20 minutes, is Repo, the Genetic Opera. I just have such a hard time with the songs. The songs are so poorly written to me. It's like the music isn't really catchy at all, and the lyrics just feel like they're kind of words being sung over something else, and they don't even kind of match to the music for me. I don't know if you ever even got suckered into that film, but for me, it just doesn't go at all.
I had heard of it, but I hadn't seen it. But then again, you know, I think what really, to be honest, it's like I'm not a big musical guy. And I think part of the reason why I haven't been a big musical guy was because, and this is going to be sad, and I'm going to tell you about a trauma in my childhood, so don't laugh at me, was when I was 9 years old, I was forced into a after-school daycare program that made me sit in a chair for three straight days and watch The Sound of Music over and over again. And ever since then, whenever The Sound of Music is referenced to me, I kind of have like a Vietnam flashback kind of thing. So it's a trauma that I'm working through. I've got therapists on this. But the thing is since then, I've had trouble watching musicals. And I'm just now in my advanced years, now that I'm far beyond 9 years old, working on being able to watch musicals again and really appreciate them, because there's nothing better for destroying the ability to enjoy anything than having someone force you to sit there and watch it for 3 days over and over and over again.
I can totally see you with like the little Alex, you know, eye openers and stuff. And you're like, please, sir, no, not this again.
It's a crime. It's a crime the way you're using Julie Andrews like that. Please make it stop. I can't even enjoy Mary Poppins now, you bastards.
Well, stick with me, Rob. I know some good musicals that will hopefully help you get past this block in your life. So, I mean, starting with some of the stuff that we've talked about on the show before, you know, I know you've had to have seen the Forbidden Zone, American Astronaut, some of these. They'll help you. I don't know if anything will ever cure you of that, but they'll help you get past that block.
Thank you, Doctor.
You're more than welcome. All right, we're going to take a break and play a preview from next week's show.
That's my purse! Stop him! Stop! Somebody please help me!
Go get him!
Thank you, officer.
Yeah, it's great, lady.
But you're a cop!
He's got my old badge, Sanchez. He's running around playing cop, assaulting and beating people.
Police! Drop the gun, son!
An anonymous, apparently off-duty police officer interrupted a robbery tonight, heroically confronting an armed robber with only bottles of spaghetti sauce.
I used to rob people who robbed people.
Kind of like Robin Hood?
Yeah, except I didn't give the money to the poor people.
Well, the bellman also said the guy had a hooker with him.
Buy a nice little house with a white picket fence. You live happily ever after.
I tell you what. Let's go straight to the happily ever after part, okay?
Junior could be anyone he wanted to be.
Frederick J. Fringer.
Herman Gottlieb.
I got something on the real Gottlieb.
You call me Junior.
Mugged, DOA at the San Francisco Airport Hospital.
Wouldn't use his real name.
Sergeant Hope Mosley, homicide. You ain't no cop. Oh, I'm a cop.
He's making arrests.
Police raid, everybody freeze!
Maybe you should wait and let him solve a couple more for your caseload, huh?
Stop, or I'll shoot! You just shot me!
Fired a warning shot and hit you.
Unfortunately, the person he decided to be wants Junior dead.
Hair trigger.
Stole my gun, my badge, my teeth.
Now you stay out of crime.
I promise.
Police officer!
Please! Miami Blues.
Price check. Uzi squirt gun.
Be sure to join us next week when we cover George Armitage's Miami Blues, where we'll be joined by author Scott Phillips. As they say in the 1950s, it'll be a gas.
And be sure to check out the official Projection Booth website at projection-booth.com. We'll have links. You can find out more about The Ghastly Love of Johnny X, where it might be playing a festival near you since it's still on the festival circuit, when it may be coming out on DVD or some other sundry format. Also, make sure to stop by that site. Leave us some way cool feedback, Daddy-O, and head over to iTunes and leave us some feedback there. Star us there, because that's a big help for us here in the podcast world of Projection Booth. And as they say, let's rumble, Daddy-O.
Here we go.
Baby, we're on our way.
Driving across the desert just to have some fun.
Here we go. Baby, we're on our way.
Driving up to Vegas, gonna have some fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're gonna shoot some craps.
Yeah.
Yeah, and play roulette perhaps.
Tearing up the town until we all collapse.
Cause firstly and lastly, there ain't no more ghastly one.
Are you brain damaged or drunk? We're on the air.